Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Chris Lord. Today's show takes us from the radicalisation of young men to the heart of the pornography industry via a mysterious French love story and the death of a hip-hop mogul. We explore some of this month's books and podcast releases that you should be turning to this summer. I'll be joined in the studio by John Mitchinson, co-founder of publisher Unbound, and Fiona Sturgis, the arts columnist for The Guardian and Financial Times. Plus, we'll look to Moscow to find out how Soviet music lovers smuggled banned music into the USSR via hospital x-rays in the mid-20th century. You heard me right. We'll also nip over to Edinburgh to find out how the hits and misses of the comedy acts weighed up this year at the Fringe Festival, and we're staying in Europe for, of course, the global countdown with our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Do stay tuned. So, Fiona and John, welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. Thank you for joining us. John, you've had a good holiday already this summer, and I'm sure you've been leafing through some rather good books for us. So I think that's where we'll probably start. John, you've picked out two of this month's fiction releases that caught your eye. We've got Home Fire by Camila Shamsi to kick things off. Now, this book is only out this week, and it's already been longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, hasn't it? Worthy addition, in your opinion?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the most powerful novels I've read for a long time, certainly this year. And it's her seventh novel, as you say, already longlisted for the Man Booker. And she's been shortlisted, I think, before for the Belly. She's a terrific writer.
Mm. And it's a book that's been, you know, some people call it a bit of a modern retelling of Sophocles' Antigone, of course, with this sort of tale of wayward brothers and entwined families.
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the... I don't think you need to know the plot of Antigone to get pleasure and to be shocked and moved by this story, although it does help in some ways, I suppose. Spoiler alert, it's not going to end well. Mm. And indeed, it doesn't end well, but it's perhaps one of the most moving conclusions to a novel I've read in a very long time. It moves sort of inexorably. You can feel the tragedy beginning to tighten.
So just give us a bit of an outline about what it's about.
So you've got two, basically, it's an Asian family living in Wembley. There's a twin brother and a sister, and an older sister who has brought them up. The mother died when they were young, and the father, it turns out, died on a plane when he was being transported. He was to Guantanamo Bay. So, bit of family shame. He was a bit of a chance, was a jihadi. So that's the background. On some levels, a typical Asian family, reasonably devout. On other levels, atypical. The older sister is going to Canada, where she's going to study sociology through various, without going into all the detail. The other family is the current Home Secretary, who is Karamat Lone, and his son, who is Eamon, which is a kind of anglicised or Irish-sized version of an Asian name. He's made his reputation, the father has made his reputation as being tough on the Muslim community. The Home Secretary's job, you know, famously have to be tough on crime and the causes of crime. So inevitably what happens is the younger daughter, the twin, falls in love with Eamon. That is fine, except that her brother, unbeknownst to the rest of the family, has gone and got himself radicalised and turns up being working for the media unit for ISIS.
So you've got these two families that are entwined, where on one side you've got this radicalised brother, and then you've got the sort of Home Secretary who's then...
Absolutely. So, I mean, pure, you know, classic Greek tragic situation.
Absolutely.
Compromise, the battle between duty and faith, that love, it is in essence a love story. And the love story between Anik and Eamon is very powerfully drawn. I mean, she writes with such precision and beauty. It's one of those books that it's a lovely moment in a novel when you think just the sheer difficulty of taking a story like this and making it contemporary without feeling the sort of the creaking of the scenery or that really she's having to stretch things. I think it's brilliantly done.
And one of the things as well is that it's, you know, it's set across so many different locations, isn't it? I mean, it's London, Massachusetts, when she heads off to grad school, or potentially going to grad school, also to Syria, as you mentioned, the wayward brother who heads off to Raqqa, Istanbul, Karachi. How does she... First of all, there's a sense of people always trying to escape from where they are from or where they want to be or where they should be. And also, How does she handle that in this book?
She has the basics of the plot there. And, I mean, people have pointed out that it's more Jean Anouilh's version of the tragedy than the original Sophocles, in that it's the wayward younger sister who is the driver for the plot. She is the Antigone figure. The way she actually handles it is to give each of the characters a long section of the book to themselves. I think you've got five, you're sort of triangulating the story from five points. So that helps with the different places and different times. But as I say, the inexorable kind of, you know, the mounting tension of the tragedy, when it hits, she's just its competence of a very, very high level. And you feel sympathy. I mean, it's quite difficult to write about the radicalization of a young Muslim and make that feel in any way sympathetic.
I mean, this is, as you mentioned, John, this is her seventh novel. Just briefly, do you think this might be her best yet?
I haven't read all of the other six. I have read two of her previous novels. It's the one I think I can see why it's been longlisted. I wouldn't be at all surprised if it didn't get shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I think it's contemporary and powerful. It's not a comfortable read. It does, you know, the British government don't come out well from this story. All the equivocations that one has to make in order to make multiculturalism look like it's working in the UK, this book sort of does blast a fairly big hole in that.
It's a timely reading as well. So Home Fire by Camilla Shamsi. It's out now, published by Bloomsbury. Now, John, next up, we're going to turn to Let Us Be True, the second novel by Alex Christofle. And this takes us very different place to Paris in the late 1950s, where we find Ralph and Elsa, who begin a relationship after meeting in Jacques' bar. But there are plenty of secrets to be revealed, aren't there, John?
It's a book full of secrets. It's another beautifully told love story. It's not it's not perhaps as tragic as Home Fire in the way that it works out. And there are spoilers that I won't give away, but it is about the uncovering of mysteries. It really is about two characters who grew up during the war. They meet by chance in a bar, Jacques' bar, or is it by chance? There's a very arresting opening where she thinks he is going through her bag, so she punches him repeatedly in the head, and that's the beginning of a love affair. It starts and ends in 1992, but the Jacques' bar bit in 1958, which is where they meet, their affair, to be honest, doesn't last terribly long, but it casts an immensely long shadow over his life. He has a best friend who is an Algerian. He ends up being involved in the protests in Paris during the Algerian uprising. He then also ends up on the street in 1968, facing and being badly beaten by the French police. It's a beautifully written, I think, extremely well-orchestrated novel. You're always resisting, at least I'm always resisting as a reader, sort of sentimentality in love stories. He manages not for this ever to feel sentimental. You're always interested in Elsa, who is the enigmatic woman. And though, again, rather similar to the Shamsi novel, he does that by giving each character sections of the narrative. So you go, you know, you're having the one bit of the narrative from his perspective and then another bit from Elsa's, and it's putting together a jigsaw. And it's very, very satisfying, moving. And throughout the book, I think, what makes this not a kind of melodrama or just a romance is, I mean, the incredibly, as I say, finely tuned writing, but also the philosophical reflection about the difference between what war does to people, what the sense of duty of having any kind of meaning in life, the fact that it is possible to meet someone by chance in a bar and for that to completely transform the rest of your life.
I get a sense as well, John, as well, some of the events that you picked out there, you know, you talked about the protests with regards to the Algerian War of Independence, and these various events that sort of form a backdrop there. I'm quite interested in, you know, narratives that can provide you a kind of a route through history almost in a certain sense of a certain period. And, you know, this era as well, this specific period in French history is quite interesting. You know, it's sort of, it's one of those very sensitive moments in French history, and I wonder how that's handled.
Again, he handles it. The tension in the novel is between history, this big kind of, it reminded me quite a lot of the Julian Barnes sense of an ending type of, the idea of history and then the individual. It's about revolutions and what revolutions do to people. It's about, as I say, the paralyzing effect of war, But in the end, it's one of the most beautiful kind of vindications, particularly in the Ralph character, who is the male character. Towards the end of the novel, without giving too much away, he becomes possessed by the notion of compassion, and that small, simple, unrewarded acts of kindness are the way. And it's a book that sort of lingers in the mind long after you put it down. It's a very, very, very good second novel.
Let Us Be True by Alex Christofi is out now, published by Serpent's Tale. John Mitchinson, thanks for talking books with us this afternoon. We've got lots more to get through, and you're going to stick around for us. We're going to be talking podcasts in just a moment's time. But before then, we're going to quickly head over to Russia for some music with a secret message. Now, in some of the darkest moments of the USSR, bootleggers came up with a pretty ingenious way to bring banned music to the people. Between the late 1940s and early 1960s, they'd buy used x-rays from hospitals and record onto them Western jazz and rock and roll, as well as one or two illegal Russian folk songs. Many of them, of course, were sent to the gulags. But a new exhibition set up by two Britons has just opened in Moscow's Garage Contemporary Art Gallery, called Bone Music, and it allows Russians to discover how bootleggers got around the censors in the name of music. Thomas Lowe brought us this report.
A sound of rebellion from beyond the Iron Curtain. Under constant risk of arrest, resourceful bootleggers worked to produce copies of Russian and Western music they loved, but was outlawed by the authorities.
Come over, Ulf, let me show you.
This is Stephen Coates, musician and co-curator of the Bone Music Exhibition.
What we're looking at here is a recording lathe. It's a recording machine. And the best way to imagine it is that it's a gramophone in reverse. So where is this gramophone over here? You drop a needle on a spinning vinyl record, it reads the groove and it plays that back. In this case, you drop the needle or the cutter onto a blank surface and it spins, and you feed music into it and then it writes the groove. So it makes a blank surface into a record. And as you can see here, what we've got on here is an x-ray.
X-rays were cheap and easy to get hold of. It said they were highly flammable at the time, and hospitals were told to get rid of them after a year. Bootleggers would pay a small amount of money and leave with the materials they needed. So the albums they made had ghostly images of hands, skulls, or other body parts imprinted on the surface.
Part of the exhibition is an installation, and it's the way I see it, it's like a dream of a bootlegger's room in the 1950s, and the idea is that he was sitting here about to cut this jazz record, and there was a banging on the door and the police had turned up and they take him away. That's the sort of fantasy, and we're in his room, and we're surrounded by the things that he would have used to make x-ray records, all the sound equipment. But also, at the beginning of this culture, these were music lovers. They were often described as hooligans. But in fact, at the beginning, they were quite cultured people who were passionate about music.
One of them is 80-year-old Mikhail Farafanov, who poured his soul into making illegal recordings in the mid-1950s.
I'm ready to share my knowledge of jazz with anyone and spread its popularity because I know it very well and love it like crazy.
He says you needed a good deal of nous to make the copies.
I was deceived from time to time. People sold me poor quality equipment. But I'm one of those people who always tries to get the best result possible. People came to me because I had the best apparatus and I recorded the best quality music.
Stalin only permitted radio sets which couldn't receive shortwave bands from Europe.
All receivers were made like that, but those were available on sets that were brought in from Germany and the old Soviet ones. You could get good quality sounds on them.
Western music, like jazz and rock and roll, was in high demand, but songs by banned Russian musicians were popular too. Entire musical genres were made illegal, and bootleggers worked to make them available as well. Stephen Coates again.
Criminal songs, songs of the gulag, so-called Russian chanson these days, an underbelly, like songs of the underclass and songs of the dark side of socialist realism. And of course, the authorities were not keen that got recorded. So this was a way to do that. And those songs were very popular.
The discs were a maximum 3.5 minutes long, and the sound quality wasn't great. But people still took huge risks so they could listen to the songs they loved. For Stephen, this speaks to the power of music.
This was a time when one song could be very, very valuable. It was a time when music mattered so much that some people were prepared to go to prison for it. So, in a way, that's the big story, I think, and maybe that's part of why it is so fascinating.
For Monocle, in Moscow, I'm Thomas Lowe.
Thanks to Thomas Lowe for that report from Moscow. Bone Music is on at Garage in Moscow until 5th of October. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Chris Lord, and I'm joined in the studio by John Mitchinson, co-founder of publisher Unbound, and Fiona Sturgis, the arts columnist for The Guardian and The Financial Times. We're going to talk podcasts. Fiona, let's talk about two of the series that you've been plugged into this summer, starting with Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty. Let's hear a little clip now.
Well, of course, LL was there, and
Nick Cannon. Chris used to manage Nick.
50 was there. Puffy was there.
So many people. My brother was well loved. So many people.
All these people were gathered at the Frank E. Campbell Funeral Chapel in Manhattan. That's the same place where funerals for stars like Aaliyah, Luther Vandross, and the Notorious B.I.G. were held. If you were on the street outside that day, you might have thought this was a red carpet event. Celebrities stepping out of SUVs with blacked out windows. Paparazzi were there too, looking for a spot to take the perfect shot. Bodyguards did their best to hold them back. But inside there was no award show, no new album dropping, just a casket holding the body of a man named Chris Lighty, who just a few days earlier had shocked the world.
That was a little clip from Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty. Now, Fiona, I have to say, this was a total revelation for me. It's a great podcast series. Just to give a bit of background, Chris Lighty was probably one of the most important music executives in the history of hip-hop. He produced everyone from Foxy Brown, Fat Joe, Missy Elliott, LL Cool J, 50 Cent. And also, he was so integral to a scene that developed. You know, we think of that kind of music starting at a certain moment, certainly in the 90s, of those kind of artists that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. That was their moment. Yeah. But actually, what this podcast shows, it begins much, much earlier, right back there in the Bronx, the way people were partying at that time, mm-hmm. the nightclub scene, and how Lighty kind of picked that up. Just, first of all, tell me what drew you to this podcast. What was it about this story that you think works?
I think it's a very unusual story, partly because you don't often find these series unfurling over six episodes. A lot of the American podcasts are quick in, quick out, one episode at a time. They're all very self-contained. But this one is stretched over six episodes. That's unusual. Another unusual thing about it, which is a shame, but it's the way it is at the moment, is that podcasting is a very white, middle-class occupation. There's a lot of money coming into it in America, but it's still, and it's changing, and it's evolving, and the scene's getting better, but it's very white, and it deals with very white concerns. But here we have a podcast that's dealing with black music, black culture, told by black people with nothing but black voices in it, which is quite a revelation, unusual, and I think it's a... By the time I got to the end of the podcast, I realised this is a major step in the right direction, and it feels important. It feels like, well, if this can be a hit, if this can gather huge audiences, then that opens the field much, much wider to different types of people.
What strikes me as well when you listen to this is the presenter, Reggie Osse, he gets this phenomenal access, first of all, to the family of Chris Lighty,
yes.
who are certainly, you know, very cooperative, but also this amazing selection of period sounds, you know, from everything right back there in the Bronx in Chris's early life to these parties, people talking about what it was like to be there. You know, is this, you know, when we talk about this sort of six episode, this is a new kind of biography, isn't it, that we're seeing in front of us?
It is, absolutely. And I think this primarily was driven by Reggie Osse, because he is a man, I think, with a lot of fingers and a lot of pies. He was, before becoming a full-time podcaster, he was a hip-hop attorney. So he had his own clients who included Jay-Z and Puff Daddy. So he is a very well-connected man to start with. And he and Chris Lighty knew each other, not so well, but they sort of moved in the same circle. So he had these contacts already. And then he moved into the podcasting game. And he's sort of set up shop with alongside Gimlet Media, who are very, very powerful, important and groundbreaking podcasting network. So I think the combination of these two things gave them the kind of renown, probably the budget and the contacts to create something really, you know, it's the kind of show that I think you'd find on Netflix. You'd expect to find it as a visual documentary, but actually it works beautifully in audio as well, because obviously you've got a lot of music. I don't know what deals he's made with the various record companies, but he knows people, so there are probably a lot of doors opening for him.
And what's striking as well about this story is it's got this tragic arc to it, ultimately. I mean, you know, the episode one begins with Chris Lighty's mother talking in the aftermath of his death and talking about how he died and the sort of absolute absence that was left behind by him. And just, you know, without giving too much away, I mean, because obviously it begins that way, but just give us a sense of how that story is told. What do we find out? You know, what sort of things do we find out about this person in the course of the story?
As you say, at the beginning, we hear about the funeral of Chris Lighty, so it becomes immediately clear to any listener who might be under any misapprehension, this is not a true crime show. And I think a lot of people might have gone into it, or maybe some people would have gone into it thinking this could be a true crime show. There was some speculation over his death. Was it suicide? Was it something else? So that is, to be honest, where I thought it might be going, and thank goodness it doesn't. What it does is it interweaves the history of hip-hop, which is obviously a huge story that could, you know, that could fill a library, let alone, you know, and not just six episodes in a podcast, but it interweaves that with this man's life, because he was there at the beginning. He was carrying record cases for DJ Red Alert in the late 70s or early 80s. He was working as a tour manager, I believe, in the early 80s, and then he moved into Def Jam Records. Obviously, you know, under the tutelage of Russell Simmons, meant that he was obviously going places at that time. And working with some of the biggest names in hip-hop, and not just working with them in a sort of office environment, but really getting stuck in. And there are some unbelievable stories here, which I don't want to ruin for any listeners, but, you know, of altercations with mega hip-hop stars. There are shootings, there's a party that he goes to, hosted by Russell Simmons, where people are walking around draped in snakes. I don't know if you remember that bit. It's highly evocative. So you get a sense of this man sort of gathering contacts and gathering power, moving through this scene at the most fantastic time. And his big business acumen sort of meets the evolving music in the middle, and they just run for it until by the time we get to the early 2000s, he's stupidly rich. I mean, he's got a garage full of Bentleys and whatever else, and he's, you know, got assets here, there and everywhere, and houses everywhere, and, you know, it's all about the big parties. There's an episode about his wedding, which is just the most obscene in some ways, in obscene festival of riches and celebrity.
Absolutely. I just want to jump in. One last thing to say on that as well is that, you know, before we were talking about alternative ways to tell history or finding ways that you can find a kind of divining rod through history. We're talking about it in relation to sort of mid-century Paris and so on. But this, what I find fascinating about this is that Chris Lighty is that great character who can tell you a tale, his life, of, first of all, hip-hop's evolution from the 70s through to today, but also sort of a period in New York history, in Absolutely. American history, and sort of the change of fortunes of that city as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. It's a cultural history, it's a musical history, and it's a history of one particular figure. And what's interesting about how this series unfolds is that you're being guided through it by Reggie Ossé, who's obviously very knowledgeable and incredibly empathetic. He doesn't prostrate himself at the feet of Lighty. There are some quite disturbing moments. He doesn't always acquit himself well, but he's, you know, to be blunt about it, he's dead. It's about a dead man. So we're hearing his life told through there's a few archive interviews with him, but mostly it's being told by other people. And it's so deftly done. And the way it interweaves the music as well, you don't ever lose that, oh my God, I remember this tune. Or if you don't know the tune, you know, it just lifts you out of your seat at various points.
It really does. And I advise you to tune in. That's Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty, presented by Reggie Ossé and produced by Gimlet Media. And it's available to listen to on iTunes. Now, stay in podcast. John Ronson is known for his books that take him on intrepid adventures into the weird and wonderful. These have been turned into films and TV shows. And now he's ventured into the world of podcasting. The Butterfly Effect is a story of humanity and mystery told through the setting of the porn industry. Let's hear a little excerpt from the trailer.
The woman was there to meet me. She was a veteran porn performer, and I was interviewing her for a different story. The hotel receptionist telephoned my room to tell me that my guest was waiting for me in the lobby. I went downstairs and spotted her straight away. Her dress was bright blue and very tight. Everybody else in the lobby was dressed in inconspicuous colours. She seemed so otherworldly, like a great mad peacock. I walked towards her. That's when I noticed the glance. It was the hotel receptionist. I just happened to swing around as he was looking at her. It was a look of total contempt. It made me think that some people are only comfortable with porn people when they're on their computers and not in their vicinity. So I became curious. What were their lives like? What were their concerns? I began researching, and it turned out that a lot of them were concerned about the same, very specific thing. A man called Fabian.
So just give me a sense, first of all, where does he start on this journey into the porn industry?
Well, beyond that hotel lobby, which I thought is that's where the podcast starts, where he suddenly has this sort of light bulb moment of, hang on a minute, why is it that people are looking at this woman in this way when, you know, a very high percentage of people look at porn on their laptops happily on a fairly regular basis? So from there, he seeks out a time in the evolution of porn where things changed. And he finds that in, as with many industries, the arrival of the internet, the arrival essentially of free content. So it's a very interesting take that we haven't seen done before, because we've seen plenty of BBC documentaries where there's, you know, oh my God, the porn industry, would you believe it? There's been a lot of that, or should I say Channel 5 documentaries, where it's all very sort of hysterical and over the top. But this is a very sympathetic view, and just looking at how the industry has evolved and how it's changed in the era of free content. So he starts with a man called Fabian, as we heard there, Fabian Tillman, who is essentially used to be a tech nerd. As a teenager, he was pretty much a nerd in his bedroom, thinking about how he's going to make his millions. And on looking at how people were consuming porn, he thought, we could do this for free. Here's the internet. We could do this for free. So he made that happen. Over a period of time, he had to get funding. That was difficult because people didn't want to associate themselves with the porn industry. But once he'd managed that, it seemed pretty plain sailing. So then John Ronson goes out and meets the actors and meets the filmmakers and the other sort of tech enablers, and sees how the era of free porn has actually impacted on them. And it's not all a good news story, and it's not all happy, happy, joy, joy, but it is a very warm story. It's very full of community and camaraderie and kindness.
I mean, what about, I mean, this character of Fabian and sort of these tech enablers who did this. I mean, there's a quote from John Ronson where he talks about, you know, trying to stop paid for porn entering freely into the cloud of being able to freely access by everybody would be like trying to cut down a forest with a butter knife, I think was how he described it, because it's just become completely unmanageable.
Yes.
So basically what they did was take all the money out of the industry, really, didn't they?
Pretty much. And the people who were already in the industry had to find new ways of making money. And what we find out here, which I think is new, it's a story that hasn't been told before, is not... While John Ronson hangs about on a few porn sets, and it is quite funny because it's like Alan Bennett or something in the middle of a porn set, it's very funny, and he's very sweet and innocent somehow. But he goes out and he meets people in their own environment and finds out what they're doing, how they're consuming porn, how they're making porn. And one of the most interesting parts of it was a sort of rising market in bespoke porn. So these days, if you can't find what you're looking for on Pornhub, maybe, I don't know, you've got a thing for sex dolls or sci-fi or military uniforms or whatever, you can get in touch with the makers of porn movies and say, here's your script, this is what I'd like, here's a pile of cash, off you jolly well go. Again, it's very touching, and you can laugh a little bit when we hear about the scenarios that people have proposed to these filmmakers. But actually, when John Ronson digs behind the backstories, there it's all rather touching, you know, and a little bit Freudian.
So it does show that in any field where mass production is being affected, therefore bespoke becomes even more desirable.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Now, Ronson, obviously, writer, very well known for books such as Men Who Stare at Goats, which became the famous film, and so on. How does he fare in the podcast? I mean, he's you know, he was big part of This American Life at one point as well. What about on his own when he's steering his own ship?
It's peculiar at first. I thought in the first 5 or 10 minutes, I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to get on with this. There's just too much of a gulf between what he's talking about and him. It just doesn't seem like a good fit. But at the same time, there's a slight hint of, I mentioned Alan Bennett, but also a little bit of Louis Theroux as well, that sort of wide-eyed, innocent, and seemingly thoroughly non-judgmental. He just seems to be enjoying himself, but also very, very, you know, a bit like Mogul, a very empathetic sort of host.
Is it good reporting? You know, when we think of things, you know, some of these great podcasts we've seen in recent years, like Serial being a case in point and these kind of things, you know, the bedrock of them is great reporting. Does it feel like this, or is it a little bit more whimsical than that?
No, I think it's less personal than those. I mean, you think of the latest Serial, and I'm just trying to think, some of the other Gimlet and NPR programmes, a lot of the time the hosts will involve themselves in the story, and they will sit and agonise about what they found out. Runson doesn't really do that. He retains a little bit of distance, but while using his very natural warmth to get the trust of those he's talking to. And I think what's particularly good about this is it wouldn't have worked as a TV documentary, because a lot of these people wouldn't have cooperated because they'd have had to appear on camera. But here they can just really, really bare their souls and tell their stories, tell very, very personal, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes embarrassing stories. And he's there just soaking it all up, asking uncomfortable questions, but in that sweet sort of slightly nerdy way that gains the listener's trust and gains his subject's trust, I think.
That's The Butterfly Effect with John Ronson. And it's available to download on Audible now. It'll be on iTunes in November. Fiona, thanks for your podcast tips today. Now, over the past couple of weeks, comedians and their fans have been flocking to Edinburgh for this year's Fringe Festival. It's one of the biggest comedy festivals in the world and attracts the biggest names in its field. Theatre and comedy critic for The Times, Dominic Maxwell, is there now, and we checked in with him to see who's kept the Scottish city roaring with laughter this August.
I think, like in the world in general, there's a lot of stuff about identity politics up here. And, you know, when I find myself saying that, I always imagine people's faces going a bit blankly and think, well, yes, but is it funny? But, of course, in the best hands, absolutely it is. There are some really great shows up here that make these sort of issues about identity, whether it be ethnic or sexual or gender, really funny. And there's some really middling shows that manage not to make it funny, you know, as you would expect.
And one of the shows that are dealing with those topics, your first choice, Hannah Gadsby. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, and I have to warn you that the more you explain this show, in a way, the less right you get it, because it's a show with such huge scope. It won the big award, the Barry Award, at the Melbourne Comedy Awards this year. Hannah Gadsby, she's a comedian from Tasmania. She's 39. She's been doing pretty well for a number of years. But this, she says, is her last ever show. She says that up front, and you think, oh, why? And people often say things like this. And then she goes on, A, to show why for her life has got just too serious. The issues that she's made light of in her career have just got pressing too heavily on her now for her to be able to laugh about them anymore. But while she does that in the most fantastically funny, well-delivered way that at least for about three quarters of the time, until she deliberately decides to stop being funny, makes you think, what a fantastic comedian she is.
Is it still dealing with those topics, Sarah Pascoe and John Robbins?
I guess this is a bit of a step aside from that. And as ever, when you talk about themes, you know, that's the dominant theme, but there are lots of exceptional shows that don't quite click to this. But this is something unusual. Sarah Pascoe, known from panel shows and all sorts of things, W1A, and John Robbins were a couple, both comedians, they were a couple for 4 years. Just before last Christmas, Pascoe dumped Robbins, which is a rather crude way of putting it, but that's kind of the way they talk about it too. And now, well, it's quite common for comedians to do shows about being dumped or breaking up a relationship. What's remarkable here is both individually, separately, entirely separately, doing shows about this split at the same time in the same venue.
Is it fun?
Yeah, they're both absolutely career highlights for both comedians. I mean, Pascoe is the more varied comedian, and in a way her show is about moving beyond their relationship, about becoming single, about trying to find herself. She tells some stories about going to a yoga retreat in Costa Rica and things like that, and becoming celibate. So she's sort of off gadding around finding herself. Robbins has lost 2 stone, he's kept the house, he's absolutely miserable, and his show is all about how he can't move beyond this split. And eventually it comes round to the kind of sort of anxiety he has and the kind of fastidious he has that, I mean, he says towards the end, I understand why she dumped me. And we are him at that. He says, no, ha ha, not ah. And for the most part, he absolutely gets away with it.
And finally, Dominic, there's a choice here that it's Matt Ewing's. Somehow he's kind of making fun of this identity politics, Edinburgh. Tell us a bit more about this one.
His flatmate is Richard Gadd, who won the Edinburgh Comedy Award last year with a multimedia show about sexual abuse. And so they talk about these things. Now, Matt Ewens hasn't changed his approach. He's still doing wacky, crazy, video-fueled shows. In this case, it's a sort of spoof Indiana Jones adventure that ropes the audience in, that has him in all sorts of situations put into film footage, yada, 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 on screen. Very, very funny. But what he's done that's different is he's done a little, and this is me, serious bit, sitting down sort of about 5 minutes from the end, in which he says, well, do you know what? Actually, all this lunacy, all this mucking about, I think it's important. I think there's too much Edinburgh Whinge Festival, not Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And if you have a problem, well, escape from it. Have fun. Don't dwell on it. And that's not the whole truth, but it's a very useful truth sometimes, and it absolutely justifies and actually, paradoxically, lends some depth to what is just a gloriously funny, silly hour.
Dominic, compared to other years, would you say it's been proving to be a good year so far?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough, I go around and see 5 shows in a day, so in some days you see a bunch of stuff that makes you go, wow, there's so much good stuff, and some days you see stuff that makes you go, yeah, comedy's hard, isn't it? But I think I've seen, probably at this point, we've got about a week and a half to go, I think I've seen more exciting things at this point than I normally have. There's some really good stuff, and as I say, the stuff when the issues commingle with the laughs is very beautiful and special.
Are there any things or any plays that you're looking forward to see?
I'll just briefly mention one of those ones. It's another identity politics thing. It's a woman called Sophie Willen. It's a great example of someone who had a pretty good show last year, got a bit of chat about her, has come back, and this time she's really delivered. That's all about being northern and working class and female, and that being treated as a novelty in the comedy industry. But she goes on to do something a little bit more personal as well. So that was the one I was looking forward to, and I just saw it last night, and that is the one I would point to people towards. If that doesn't get an award nomination, the Comedy Awards nomination, I'll be surprised and disappointed.
Dominic Maxwell there, speaking to us from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We're almost at the end of today's show, but it wouldn't be the Monocle Arts Review without Fernando Augusto Pacheco here to lead us through a lineup of music from lesser-known charts from around the world, perhaps. Where are we heading today, Fernando?
We're heading to a very summery chart. It's in France, and I quite like the top 5. It's very mixed, and there's some old... Well, should I say classics? Wait and you see why I'm saying this. Number 5, we have DJ Khaled with Rihanna and Bryson Tiller. The song's called Wild Thoughts. The interesting thing about this song, you know, we know about Despacito as being number 1 literally everywhere around the world. I think this might be the next Despacito. It's climbing very slowly in the charts. He's an American, I think, from Palestinian origin, and he's doing very well. I mean, he has got a lot of connections. I think he worked as a producer as well. So yeah, he's on the rise for sure.
So that's your tip? That might be the Despacito for this song.
I think so. Wow. Give 3 weeks to the song. Who knows?
Who's in number 4?
Number 4, we have a Belgian Congolese rapper. His name is Danso, and the song is called Macarena, but it's not one. It's not that one.
Not that one.
Unfortunately, in some ways, because, you know, it, even though it's a rap song, but it's quite kind of romantic rap in some ways. And I was reading the lyrics translated, you know, and it's basically this girl that he loves, and he says, my heart dances to Macarena, la la la, you know, but there's no funky beats in the background. It's
no
really
hand gestures.
No hand gestures. In some ways, it's a shame. But
So from the Congolese Macarena to Ed Sheeran, he had to be on there, didn't he?
He had to be on there. But that's
even in France.
Even in France. And the song is Shape of You. Do you believe that this song has been on the chart for 28 weeks now? It's a long time, you know, and staying in number 3, I think it's remarkable. And he did release like some follow-up singles, but I think people are still entranced by Shape of You.
Where, looking at this French lineup now, where do these lineups sit elsewhere? Like, you know, if we look around Europe at the moment, Fernando, are we going to find Damso in other parts of Europe on that top 5?
Well, you certainly find Damso in Belgium, you know, where he's from, especially in the French part, because in Belgium there's quite a division. about what's popular in the French part of Belgium and the kind of more the Dutch part, the Wallonia and Flanders. To be honest, the chart is quite specific French, especially, you know, we should wait until number one, which is a French artist. I don't think he's very popular yet outside France, you know, because again, it's another French rapper. I think French rap is a difficult genre to translate to other countries in some ways. But, you know, it could be the next trend, you know.
Coming in at number two is Louis Fonsi, of course.
Yeah.
Now, presumably he's sat at number one for a little while. And
yeah,
then,
absolutely.
Okay, yeah. And it's been well received in France otherwise, I guess, then, yeah?
Very much so.
Has it been as ubiquitous there as it has been here and elsewhere?
And there's a distinction here. In France, the version without Justin Bieber, it's number two. Because some countries, like, for example, the UK, the US, you kind of need a little Justin Bieber here, you know, because otherwise people will not listen
really?
To it.
Really?
Yeah. No, you know what I mean?
It goes a long way.
Yeah. Didn't Justin Bieber say hello, you know, just some words in English, yeah. And then, you know, he's kind of almost supporting a song that is not sang in English in some ways.
And so that was knocked off the top spot by?
By Niska. Shall we hear a clip of it? And then I want to hear your opinion on it.
Sound of Niska there. Tell us a bit about him, Fernando.
He's a young French rapper. I think that's the song's from his second album only. He's very young. I think he's about like 25. And the song's called Réseau, and which became a major hit this summer. The video clip is very popular. And again, the lyrics are quite fluffy because, you know, when you say French rap, you might say, oh, is it a bit political? Or not the song in particular, you know. Again, it's about a girl. I think he was interested in this girl, but she was not interested in him. And then she saw him on TV, and then she's like, oh, you're on TV, so I want to have you. But it's like, no, you can't, you know. So
I mean, this is a common theme of this lineup, I would say. I think this is like the third song that's followed that narrative, I would say, Fernando.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
It's so summer.
It's summer.
It's a summer hit, isn't it?
I like the hooky little track in the background.
Yeah.
Yodely kind of.
Yeah, it's Pululu, actually. I was just asking our French intern, I was like, what is Pululu? Because I couldn't. And it's like baby talk in French.
Right.
Apparently, in this song, there's a lot of baby talk. It might be a bit creepy, ooh, but oops, you know.
Wow. The soundtrack to your French.
There's a lot of Lulu, Pululu, I don't know.
In the vocoder, it won't die, will it?
Yes, no.
That brings us to the end of today's programme. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I'm Chris Lord. To play us out, let's hear a bit more baby talk from that number one track from Niska. This is Rizou. Thanks for listening. Nazareth, tous les jours je fume, je me dis demain j'arrête. Ne te fie pas à mon gabarit, je viens du 9-1, je sais me bagarrer.